just as we've done the last few weeks. We're going to have a lecture today that kind of outlines a bit of the content. And then on Thursday, we'll have a similar lecture that is taking the same topic but looking at a case study. So today we're going to be looking at introverts and quiet creativity. And on Thursday, we're going to be looking at an example of someone who was an introvert and focused themselves on creative accomplishments. So this is very much tied to our reading for this week, which is a book by Susan Cain called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in the World That Can't Stop Talking. This is a really, really good book, another one that I would recommend the whole book, especially if you're an introvert. It's a really interesting book to read. But there's a chapter in that where she talks about the power of being an introvert and how introvert behavior can be a great source of creativity. But her notion in general is that we're in a world that can't stop talking. You know, we're in a world that really favors extroverts. So she's being an advocate for introverts in what she considers to be a world that favors extroverts. And she is asking the question, how did extroversion become the cultural ideal? And it's interesting, she looks quite historically at how extroverted or introverted personalities have been prevalent or less prevalent all through different periods of time. And she makes the claim that the 20th century really transformed our idea about extroversion. And it did it through businessmen and salesmanship. That before the 20th century, there really was nothing like advertising. There was nothing like public relations. There was nothing like social media. There was nothing like ad campaigns. Those just didn't exist before the 20th century. And it really was a rise of a certain kind of business in the 20th century that then began to promote this hyperbole. How do we make a big, strong point and sell whatever we're trying to sell? And she goes through a whole history of how that transition occurred in the 20th century and how America shifted from a culture of character to a culture of personality. And she relies heavily in this on cultural historian Warren Sussman. This is something I want all the way through the lecture today. I'm going to have a number of these interludes where I want you to tell me, what do you think about this? So this is the first big question here is, wow, is this true that America had shifted in the 20th century from a culture of character to a culture of personality? So Sussman actually talks about the fact that personality as a term didn't even exist in English until the 18th century. And the notion of having a good personality was not common until the 20th century. It wasn't even a concept that human beings looked at. And it's very interesting when you read, like, biographies of some of our early presidents. They were not big personalities. George Washington was not, we think of leader, you know, big, strong, outgoing personality. No, he was kind of a quiet guy. And terrible, terrible speech maker. When he would stand up and occasionally have to make a speech, which he hated to do, but when he did stand up and make a speech, he had such a tiny little voice that people couldn't hear it. And it was impossible. And, you know, things like we think of the State of the Union, you know, President delivering the State of the Union. No, they wrote it and sent it to Congress. They did not present it orally. This whole idea of the charismatic, outgoing personality, it really didn't have much weight until well into the 20th century. So according to Sussman, this culture of personality requires everyone to kind of be a performing self. You're constantly trying to perform and and impress. And, you know, this is something I want to hear your point of view on this. But I think this has gotten more and more and more to the point where people in their personal interactions are often performing. They're kind of not really relating one-on-one. They're kind of making a performance. And maybe the most popular people around are the ones that are better at that performance. They're like being a stand-up comic 100% of the time when they're with other people. And that's what makes them popular, is this kind of ability to perform and be this kind of outgoing public persona. So Sussman outlines this difference between a culture of character and a culture of personality. And he says that, you know, this culture of character has existed for millennia, and that's how people assess other human beings. And that's how they made their choices about a spouse, for example. I'm looking for someone who has character. I'm looking for someone who is works hard, they're honorable, they have a good reputation, they have high moral standards, they have good manners, they have integrity, they're honest, they understand duty and citizenship. These were traits that you judged people by, and that you elected public officials by their character, and you chose your friends by their character, and you chose your spouse by their character, and you tried to raise your kids to have really good character. And these were the predominant criteria for successful human beings. And that Sussman says that we have moved to more a culture of personality, where it's much more important to be magnetic, fascinating, stunning, attractive, and glowing, and dominant, and forceful, and energetic. These kinds of things have become the criteria for, you know, who we elect as a public official. They've become the criteria for even who we're attracted to as you know, someone we'd want to date or someone we'd want to marry. They're traits that we engender in our children. We try to help them have these big personalities so that they can be successful in the world. This shift he observes from a culture of character to a culture of personality. So I want to hear your perception on that. Is Sussman kind of full of shit? No, I don't think that's happening. Or do you observe that actually to be true? And is it maybe even more true in your generation than in my generation? Where are we going in terms of these cultural values? What do you think?
Okay, so my dad, I would say, calls these people that are representing the culture of personality, he calls them fast talkers, and he absolutely can't stand them. It was embedded in me from like a young age that you back up everything you say with action, and you really represent who you are by what you do and not what you say. So I completely agree that we have shifted to a culture of personality, and that it's really unfortunate that to be well-liked, you have to be magnetic or stunning or attractive or things like that, because I think some of the most amazing people are those people that you really just have to look at their actions rather than what they say or what they look like. So,
good point. What other people think? Yeah. I think historically speaking, this has always kind of been true. It's just easier to see in this day and age because of things like social media and the internet and transparency. But even if you go back to like philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche, he would describe people who had a culture of character as kind of being in a slave morality. That's everything you don't want to be. Whereas a culture of personality is kind of like the Ubermensch. This is what everyone should strive for in order to, you know, kind of have the best life. So I think it's always been here. It's just now we can see it better.
Interesting.
What do other people think? What do you think has made this shift, if the shift has occurred? Yeah, what do you think?
I think with the emergence of, like, TV and technology, this kind of idea of pop culture became, like, very important, and just, like, especially in our generation, because it was so, like, just prominent. And with that, there was kind of a set, like, an ideal of, like, what a person should be like, and it's, like, what was shown on TV, and it's, like, something that just, like, kind of surrounded us all the time and created that mindset.
So there are in particular TV shows now, like the Housewives of X, where it really is all about all those words on the right. And in fact, I've only ever watched this in 10-minute snippets in the gym, but it looks like things like integrity or honor or morals, those are like bummers. Who would want to hang out with anyone who had those? And they're denigrated in that whole very popular series of TV shows. In reality TV shows, who gets off the island? Who wins? Is it the person who is honest and no intrigues and very honorable? Or is it the person who is dominant and forceful? Who wins in reality TV shows? These, I think, as you pointed out, these are important social forces. So, is this a good thing? Is this not a good thing? What do you think about this? I have thoughts about this. This is a big question. What is the key to success? Is it those words on the right? Is it those words on the left? Yeah, what do you think?
So I kind of feel like we've kind of become like a culture more like self-centered. Like we've just kind of put ourselves around like, you know, being at the front, being in the spotlight, where we, you know, kind of want to be in charge versus like before it was like, you didn't want to be in charge if you were, like, chosen to lead, you were a leader. You know, like, it was more of, like, a duty rather than, or a privilege rather than it was, like, something that, you know, was, you know, entitled to or something like that. It's just, like, a lot of those traits are just, like, just very self-centered.
Interesting. Did you have something?
I was just going to piggyback off what someone else said, that our society now, the only way to, like, what I see, again, in social media is to have the right side. Because, you know, we look at the Kardashians whose entire, you know, life work is based on looks and how they look. And, you know, we have Instagram who these models, both men and women, make their living off posting on Instagram based on how they look. It's entirely, in this day and age, that side, I feel like.
And do you think that's good or bad?
I can't tell you right now. I don't know where this is going. Right now I'm just seeing it. But it could be good. For some people it's a way to get, you know, it's a new way of work for some people.
Interesting. Yeah, what do you think?
I don't think that's entirely the right side. I think people who stay on the left just aren't in public eye as much. And I think most of the background of a lot of things that we enjoy, like the platforms that people on the right sort of showcase themselves on, are made by, or kept running by people on the right. I mean, on the left, on the side of character. And I think it's just we have more exposure to people who identify with culture personality. So it's hard to remember that you don't have to be that way.
Interesting.
I feel like you brought up this question and sort of at the get-go of asking the question kind of put a negative light on the fact that we're changing to a culture of personality or we may be changing to a culture of personality. I don't think there's anything in that list of words that's like inherently wrong. Maybe having, maybe valuing, you know, attractiveness above morals is an issue, but like the word itself, I don't think that that's a problem, and I don't think that there's any reason why you can't do both.
So I want to make clear, I'm not selling one way or the other. This is Warren Sussman who's observed this, and Susan Cain who says it's kind of a relevant thing to be thinking about. I don't want to say, I mean, honestly, some of those words on the right, I work very hard myself to have those characteristics. I do. because I think they will make, they'll be useful to me. So I'm not knocking that. I personally think those words on the left, we don't talk about them enough, and we're maybe not promoting them enough in our culture, and sometimes they get kind of even bad-mouthed, which I think is a pity, because I think those are good words on the left, too. But I'm just, Brian, I want you to think whatever you think about this, and figure out what things you think you want to optimize. Yeah.
So I think it's definitely true that the culture of personality is what leads to success today, especially like if you're recruiting for like a job and you're going in for an interview, they're looking for the words on the right, not necessarily the left. But I think that I personally think that this shift is problematic because it's based on a cycle of like instant gratification, and it's sort of spills over to like the youth of today's generation, where they don't really understand the values on the left anymore. They only care about the things on the right, and it sort of shifts away, allowing them to understand the importance of the things on the left. For example, having citizenship, having like a good work ethic, but rather they're more focused on being the attractive person, being like a more fascinating person in their everyday lives. I think that shift is problematic.
Interesting. Did you have something else? Yeah. One more comment, then we're going to move on. What do you think?
I don't think it's necessarily good or bad. I think it's important to understand that you can have a mix of both. And yes, I do think that in this day and age, we are shifting more towards like the right side. But I think it's important to like remember the left. And I think a lot of people want to be like the left, but are kind of forced into the side of the right just because of the society that we're in.
Interesting observation. So let's see where Susan Kenny takes this notion. She says really that all of this substantially got started in the 20th century with this guy, Dale Carnegie. And he, especially in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and the 50s, he published a whole series of books. And it was a notion that you could get that personality that maybe you didn't have. So if you were in the culture of character and you were missing the kind of personality side of it, that you could rewire your brain, you wouldn't use those terms, but you could get those characteristics. And his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, was a bestseller. It was like second only to the Bible for about 10 years in terms of sales. It was an extremely popular and influential book in America, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And it was really about developing a personality for yourself as opposed to just those more traditional notions of character. So read the Bible, the character side of it, and read How to Win Friends and Influence People to get the personality side of it. So Susan Cain says Carnegie's metamorphosis from a farm boy to salesman to public speaking icon is also the story of the rise of the extrovert ideal. He himself had made that transformation. He was helping other people understand how to do that. She says, Carnegie's journey reflects a cultural evolution that reached a tipping point around the turn of the 20th century, changing forever who we are and whom we admire, how we act at job interviews, and what we look for in employ, how we court our mates, and how we raise our children. So this is Susan Cain, and again, this is her perspective on this. She says, even businesses that employ many artists, designers, and other imaginative types often display a preference for extroversion. So is this a career kind of trait that's important? She says, we want to attract creative people, the director of human resources at a major media company told me. When I asked what she meant by creative, she answered without missing a beat, you have to be outgoing, fun, and jazzed up to work here. So what creative meant to this employer was you have to be outgoing, fun, jazzed up. That's what a creative person is like. Susan Cain says, if we assume that quiet and loud people have roughly the same number of good and bad ideas, then we should worry if the louder and more forceful people always carry the day. This would mean that an awful lot of bad ideas prevail while good ones get squashed. So if we're just looking at how do we move ahead as a creative culture, are we sometimes losing really good ideas because they're ideas that occurred to people who have smaller, quieter personalities, and that the people who are louder and bigger personalities tend to prevail, and maybe we're not getting the best ideas, we're just getting the ones that happen to occur to more forceful people. Again, Susan Cain, she says, studies in group dynamics suggest that this is exactly what happens. We perceive talkers as smarter than quiet talks, even though grade point averages and SAT and intelligence test scores reveal this perception to be inaccurate. That we somehow think of people with bigger personalities as smarter, having better ideas, more creative, more prevailing in the marketplace of ideas. She says, in one experiment in which two strangers met over the phone, those who spoke more were considered to be more intelligent, better looking, and more likable. We also see talkers as leaders. So this was a big study where they had people meet over the telephone. So all they're experiencing is the way this person talks. But then people got an impression of them as better looking, although they never saw them. But the better talkers were perceived to be better looking, more likable, more intelligent, and more leaders. She says it also helps to speak fast. We rate quick talkers as more capable and appealing than slow talkers. I experienced very much myself when I went to high school in Texas and then I went to college in Boston. Bostonians speak very fast. Yankees in general spoke very fast. As a Texan, I spoke much slower. And I realized that people thought I was dumb because I didn't talk as fast as they did. And I actually had to learn to talk faster so that people wouldn't think I'm a dumb southerner because they perceived how fast you talk as an indication of how fast your brain worked and how smart you were and whether or not you had something worth listening to. So again, she's saying, observing some of these other studies, Susan Cain says, in one study, groups of college students were asked to solve math problems together and then to rate one another's intelligence and judgment. So they're just solving math problems together and then they're rating intelligence and judgment. The students who spoke first and most often were consistently given the highest rating, even though their suggestions and math SAT scores were no better than those of the less talkative. These same students were given similarly high ratings for their creativity and analytical powers during a separate exercise to develop a business strategy for a startup company. So the people who talked fast, who spoke up first, who talked more, they were the ones who were given higher ratings on all kinds of things. Creativity, analytical powers, ability to be successful in a startup, intelligence, judgment, all of those kinds of things. Now, again, this is very subliminal messages. It isn't like, oh yeah, that person talks fast, they must be smart. But we're not making those connections. It's just in the back of our head, who do we consider the smarter people? Who do we consider the people who have better ideas? Who do we consider the more creative people? And she's saying that in these studies, unconsciously, we're giving it to the people who talk fast and talk more and volunteer their ideas quicker. So I want to know if you think that's true. Do you think that people consider people who are more outgoing, who speak up more often, who are faster talkers, do you think that there is a notion that somehow they're more intelligent, more capable? What do you think?
I think that, yes, it's often perceived that way, because often people who, like, speak up first and share their answers first are perceived to be more confident. And then if you think back as to, like, why they're confident, well, you think it's probably because they're better looking and they're smarter and they're all the positive traits that come with developing confidence. So I think that is, yeah.
Interesting. So then maybe it's confidence is one of those things that we really admire. And that confidence is bound to come from something, and it must mean that they have been successful and that they have produced. And so that confidence then makes us think, well, you know, I can rely on them. They are smarter. They are more capable. Do you think that's true? Do we think we perceive people with outgoing personalities and people who talk more, talk faster, volunteer their opinion more? Do we perceive them as smarter, more creative, more analytical? Yeah, what do you think?
I was watching this video the other day, and it was about Apple and Tesla presentations when they're unveiling their new products. And it was showing how Apple, the main way they sell their stuff is by selling it. Like when Tim Cook presents the item, it's about his confidence. Like, I don't know, they're comparing like videos between like Elon Musk presenting his cards, and he wasn't very prepared or confident in his product. And it was like showing that like, even though they're both great products, like people might like are more outgoing to the people are more confident.
So that maybe the way we choose a CEO for Apple is one absolute criteria is they have to be able to stand up on that stage and be charismatic and get everyone's attention and make them think, man, that is an amazing new product Apple's coming out with. And if they can't stand up there and deliver that kind of verbal message, they can't be the CEO, they can't be a leader. That's a big handicap. Interesting. So, this is all very germane to, if we want to be successful at creative problem solving, we got to figure out, well, what is the system here and what does produce success? So, Susan Cain would make the observation that a sophisticated society needs both introverts and extroverts and needs to respect them equally. That's what she thinks. So she follows this like we were looking at Jane Goodall last time, animal behavior precedent, that she observes it once in a while. A newspaper or TV program runs a story about animal personalities, casting shy behavior as unseemly and bold behavior as attractive and admirable. And this guy, David Sloan Wilson, who's an evolutionary psychologist, believes that both types of animals exist because they have radically different survival strategies, each of which pays off differently at different times. So the point here is that we should not be focusing on extroverts to the diminution of introverts, because any kind of society, animal society, a human society, we need both introverts and extroverts for survival. These both personality types are very important for the survival of the species. So this guy, David Sloan Wilson, did this experiment where he dropped metal traps into a pond full of pumpkin seed fish. These are dangerous traps for these fish. He just plops them into a bunch of pumpkin seed fish. And the bold fish couldn't help but investigate. They're curious. And they rushed headlong into his traps. And they got trapped. The shy fish hovered judiciously at the edge of the pond, making it impossible for Wilson to catch them. So the extrovert fish made themselves vulnerable by jumping in there. The introvert fish saved themselves from being caught by being judiciously cautious. After Wilson succeeded in trapping both types of fish, The bold fish, however, acclimated quickly to their new environment and started eating a full 5 days earlier than their shy brethren. So then, when placed in a new context, the extrovert fish adapted, whereas the introvert fish were stymied, and they didn't even start eating for 5 days later. So he makes the conclusion, David Sloan Wilson, that there's no single best animal personality, but rather a diversity of personalities maintained by natural selection. So these animal species need that range of personalities in order to be successful as a species. As regards problem solving in particular, introverts have been shown to excel at something psychologists call insightful problem solving. So maybe introverts have some problem solving capabilities that extroverts don't have, and that's been called insightful problem solving. Introverts are not smarter than extroverts, according to IQ scores. The two types are equally intelligent. But on many kinds of tasks, particularly those performed under time or social pressure, or in solving multitasking, extroverts do better. So maybe there are some problem-solving tasks that introverts do better, some problem-solving tasks that extroverts do better. And maybe if we're looking at creative problem-solving in a holistic sense, we need some introverts and we need some extroverts, or we need some introvert capabilities and some extrovert capabilities. But introverts seem to think more carefully than extroverts, as the psychologist Gerald Matthews describes in his book. Extroverts are more likely to take a quick and dirty approach to problem solving, trading accuracy for speed, making increasing numbers of mistakes as they go, and abandoning ship altogether when the problem seems too difficult or frustrating. So extroverts are good at that quick take and jumping quickly, but that they maybe don't have the patience or they don't have the stick-to-itiveness to really carry the problem through sometimes. Introverts think before they act. They digest information thoroughly, stay on task longer, give up less easily, and work more accurately. So is it possible that there are some introvert characteristics that are really contributive in creative problem solving, and there are some extrovert characteristics that are really important, and that to really solve problems, we can't just have one characteristic or the other. We've got to have both of those characteristics to get the job done. Susan Cain says, it's as if extroverts are seeing what is, while their introverted peers are asking what if, so that the introverts are a little deeper and more patient, and they stick with the problem longer, and they're constantly getting deeper and deeper into what if this, what if that, whereas the extrovert tend to jump to quick conclusions, maybe have a fast take on something, and can find a solution very immediately, but it may not be quite as deep or as rich as the introverts. Okay, a little bit of feedback. In your experience, do you think that these characteristics are accurate? Or do you think that's a misrepresentation?
So there are bound to be many of you who would characterize yourself as introvert. What do you think your strengths are in problem solving? There are bound to be plenty of you who characterize yourself as extrovert. What do you think your strengths are in problem solving? Do you think there is this distinction between the two, or do you think there's really no difference? What do you think?
Well, I generally categorize myself as an extrovert, but I think that there's a danger in making these two sides of thinking too distinct, because I think most people have a little bit of both. But what I think some extroverts have that introverts don't is they have a little bit of a greater tendency and aptitude to
express their ideas, and so that can help actually process them with other people, so they kind of have that, I guess, just natural tendency to do it, whereas introverts kind of have to rely on their own thinking more.
So that brainstorming, that extroverts are very good at brainstorming, they get those ideas out quickly and easily, and then they can be in the marketplace of ideas, and they can be disseminated and discussed and evaluated, and that's a really helpful thing in problem solving. Introverts might keep their ideas to themselves. They're not then contributing to that groupthink. And also maybe they're having to just rely on their own native ideas and capabilities and maybe not benefiting from what other people might have as input. And I could not agree more that we're talking about sort of extrovert capabilities and introvert capabilities. That doesn't mean one human being can't have both extrovert and introvert capabilities. It's just that those personalities might have different capabilities in terms of problem solving. So let's see what else she says. Introverts, not surprisingly, like to work alone. They may not be great at group activities like brainstorming, exactly what we're talking about here. And brainstorming, I mean, one of the things in discussion sections, which all of you are in discussion section, the TAs and I talk about the discussion sections, the bane of our existence is this brilliant kid who has really good observation and amazing ideas, and you can't get him to say anything in discussion section. So nobody else in discussion section is getting the benefit of their brilliance. And you know they're brilliant because you read their damn think sheets. And you read their Twitter cards and you think, holy shit, this is a really smart person. But you can't get them to say anything in the discussion section. And the discussion section is not benefited from the value they could add. So sometimes introverts are not contributing to the brainstorming. But according to Susan Cain, group brainstorming doesn't actually work. So this is interesting. I would be a big advocate of brainstorming. I think it does work. But just to give you the other point of view, Susan Cain is a classic introvert herself, and she's a big advocate for introverts. And she says that group brainstorming doesn't actually work. So she points to this study that was done by Marvin Donat, a psychology professor at the University of Minnesota. He gathered 48 research scientists and 48 advertising executives and asked them to participate in both solitary and group brainstorming sessions. Now, he presumed that the research scientists are more introverted and the advertising executives are more extroverted. So he got 48 of each of them. Donat was confident that the executives would benefit from the group process. He was less sure that the research scientists, who could be considered more introverted, would profit from the group work. So he was thinking there would be a difference between these two groups in how much they benefited from this brainstorming exercise. So he divided the 48 people into 12 groups of four. And each foursome was given a problem to brainstorm. Everyone was often given a similar problem to just solve on their own, individually. So he's got two different kinds of people, more introverted people, the research scientists, more extroverted people, the advertising executives. And then he's asking them to do two different kinds of exercises. One, where we're finding how many ideas we can come up through brainstorming, and the other one, how many ideas you can come up with individually. Okay, the one thing that was interesting is he found no difference between the advertising executives and the research scientists. They came up with equal numbers of ideas in brainstorming sessions and equal number of ideas in individual sessions. So we didn't actually see a big distinction in whether brainstorming was successful to them or not. This was the results that were surprising. The results were unambiguous, and they were men in this case, and 23 of the 24 groups produced more ideas when they worked on their own than when they worked as a group.
They also produced ideas of equal or higher quality when they were working individually. So in this particular study, brainstorming did not produce higher quality of ideas or more ideas than individuals working on their own. Now, this is kind of an old study. It was a thorough study, but it was kind of an old study. But Susan Cain relies pretty heavily on this. She says, the evidence from science suggests that business people must be insane to use brainstorming groups. This is a conclusion with organizational psychologist Adrian Ferdy. If you have talented and motivated people, they should be encouraged to work alone, and creativity or efficiency is their highest priority. So the real question here, if in fact brainstorming is not a very good technique for generating great ideas, then if introverted people are not good at brainstorming, what the hell difference does it make? It's not a very useful thing anyway. So I want to know, what do you think about brainstorming? Is this an important capability, or is brainstorming really not a very productive thing? Yeah, what do you think?
Actually, the big value in brainstorming, at least as I've seen it, is more the capability to like convey your ideas to other people. At least personally, I find myself like in groups. I critique my ideas a lot more before I like open up and share them versus if I'm like evaluating all possibilities on my own, I'm more likely to like be more open to all my ideas. Like I give them a more level playing field versus like the ones that are more out there, I tend not to share with the group.
Interesting. So maybe it makes you a little more selective in your ideas, if you're brainstorming, because you don't want to seem like a dumbass producing some idea that maybe is not very good. So you're very selective. And maybe more self-critical, which is a very good thing, to evaluate your ideas and see, you know, which are the best, which are not so good. So you're running through that just because you're brainstorming. So it's something you're doing individually, but in a brainstorming context, you're being more critical of your own ideas. What do other people think about the value of brainstorming or the irrelevance of brainstorming? Yeah, I think.
Brainstorming is important, but it really depends on the individual or the individuals that you collaborate to brainstorm, because I feel that sometimes people who collaborate, maybe they'll feel inclined to put in less work because they're relying on like the group result. So I think it just, in the end, depends on the individual's collaborating.
So you have to have a lot of personal responsibility if you're brainstorming. Everybody's got to be serious about, yeah, I need to be doing my part here.
I think brainstorming is really important because even when I'm doing something that's more individual in nature, I hate to work on like my art projects alone and run by myself because sometimes I'll have ideas and I won't be able to know for sure whether, like if it's like a project where I need to carefully assemble something, I don't want to use an idea that might end up ruining what I've already done. So I bounce ideas off. I go to rooms where I can work with other people nearby, even if I'm not talking to them always, just to bounce ideas. And I think that's like crucial for me, my success.
Yeah.
Okay, so like if there's any merit to like, you know, somebody always kind of going to the front and taking, you know, that initiative, then I feel like, you know, in brainstorming groups, a lot of times it'll be just like a reflection of that one person's ideas, and like they'll kind of overshadow everybody else in that.
So that is a danger of brainstorming, where the extroverts start being bullies, and they sort of dominate, and maybe introverts even accept that as, well, you know, maybe my idea wasn't that good, or, yeah, that's a really great idea, I'll neglect my own, because I'll gravitate to something that somebody else put out there. And so we get a little lazy ass maybe in brainstorming because somebody else might have the good idea and that's okay and let that prevail and now the heat's off me. Yeah, what do you think?
I think it's also related to the idea that we kind of fear rejection, because many times you may have a really good idea that you think is great, but when you tell it to the group, it might be shut down really fast, and that might limit you from wanting to speak in the future. And based on the study that she was talking about, I kind of understand where she's coming from, that if you have a group, you're less likely to brainstorm because you aren't putting out ideas that they're going to be on the list. It's just everybody's critiquing it as they come. So they're spending less time on just getting the ideas out and more time on just one idea.
So maybe in a brainstorming context, you're filtering much more quickly than you would if you were just working on your own. Okay, so let's take this another step further. Is the tendency toward introversion or extroversion hardwired from birth? Is this something that's just built into us? And that we really can't do much about? So this Jerome Kagan, this is a really famous psychologist, one of the three or four most famous psychologists in the 20th century. And he did a long-term study on whether or not introversion and extroversion are hardwired. In a series of longitudinal studies, he followed children from infancy through adolescence, documenting their physiologies and personalities along the way. So he exposed a group of 4-month-olds, they're tiny, tiny little babies, to a carefully chosen set of new experiences, loud balloon pumping, combined with colorful mobiles and strong scents like alcohol. And about 20% of the kids cried lustily and pumped their arms and legs. And these are called high reactivity groups. So if you inject some new thing into their context, they react very, very vigorously. About 40% stayed quiet and placid, and they were the low reactivity group. Those in the high reactivity group were more likely to become introverts with serious, careful personalities. So this is, even as a tiny, tiny baby, the people who react strongly to unfamiliar things tend to be introverts. And kids who are pretty blasé to these unusual happenings in their surroundings, they tend to be extroverts and have more relaxed and confident personalities. The high reactivity children pay attention to people and things, and they think very and feel very deeply. The high reactivity types are like orchids. They wilt easily, but under the right conditions, they might grow strong and magnificent. So these were very vulnerable to these activities, and it made them kind of nervous and they reacted intensely. They do tend to feel and see things more deeply. And in the right context and upbringing, they turn out to be super successful. These orchid children are more strongly affected by all experiences, both positive and negative. And these kids are especially vulnerable to challenges like marital tension, a parent's death or abuse. They're more likely than their peers to react to these events with depression, anxiety, and shyness. So just genetically, just by their makeup from the beginning, when they hit these tough times, they sometimes have problematic reactions. High reactive kids who enjoy good parenting, child care, and stable home environments tend to have fewer emotional problems and more social skills than their lower reactive peers. Often they're exceedingly empathetic, caring, and cooperative. So their upbringing tends to be more crucial in how successful they end up being, but if they're put in a, if they have a positive upbringing, they actually become extremely responsible and successful older human beings. They're kind, conscientious, and easily disturbed by cruelty, injustice, and irresponsibility. Everything about these kids, the high reactive kids, was different. Their eyes dilated more widely when they were solving problems. Their vocal cords became more tense when they were uttering words. Their heart rate patterns were unique. The footprint of a high or low reactive temperament never disappeared in adulthood. So he followed these kids all the way through to adulthood. And even in adulthood, they had these physiological differences from their low reactive peers. So this is really interesting. Introverts salivate more
than extroverts from the taste of images. When asked to adjust sound levels for comfortable listening, introverts choose 17 decibels lower than extroverts. Introverts sweat more than extroverts. So all of this science tends to point to the fact that, yes, we do have kind of hardwired into us a different level of reactivity that then leads us to be more introverted or more extroverted. The tendency toward high reactivity or low reactivity resides in the portion of the brain called the amygdala. Sometimes that's called the lizard brain. And it's the most primitive and most deep part of the brain. It's right in the center of the brain. Our inborn temperaments influence us regardless of the lives we lead, but we can certainly stretch our personalities up to point. The neocortex, and particularly the frontal cortex, can be focused to temper reactions in the amygdala. So when you're inclined to be introverted, but you want to exert extrovert behavior, it's a matter of your frontal lobe overcoming the tendency of your amygdala. So the amygdala is there inclining you to be an introvert, but you can use the frontal cortex as a way of tempering those messages. If you are a high reactive baby, then your amygdala may, for the rest of your life, go a bit wild every time you introduce yourself to a stranger at a cocktail party. It's just gonna have that reaction. But if you feel relatively skilled in company, that's partly because your frontal cortex is there to say, calm down, it's in the handshake and a smile, and everything's going to be okay. In fact, a recent fMRI study shows that when people use self-talk to reassess upsetting situations, activity in their prefrontal cortex increases in an amount correlated with the decrease of activity in their amygdala. So this is just rewiring your brain. If you are a high reactivity baby and you have a tendency to be an introvert, your amygdala will always, through your whole life, send a signal to you to be introverted. But your frontal cortex can easily overcome that signal, make you comfortable in those situations. And it's just a matter of the activity of your amygdala and your frontal cortex working in concert with each other. And it goes the other way too. If your amygdala is not giving you those warning signs, your prefrontal cortex can alert you to those warning signs and make you a little more introverted and cautious rather than you just being extroverted all the time. So this is back to our notion of rewiring your brain. If you want to be have more extroverted characteristics, that's entirely possible to do. You just use your prefrontal cortex to overpower the messages of your amygdala, or vice versa can happen as you have. So here are the questions. Are you an introvert or are you an extrovert? How can you use the inherent strengths of your temperament to make you a better problem solver? How might you adjust your inherent temperament to get just the results you want? And that leads us to our Twitter card question for today. This is a complex Twitter card question with three parts to it. I want you to think on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is extremely extroverted, and 1 is extremely introverted. 10 is extremely extroverted. 1 is extremely introverted. I want you to say...